You are listening to the INCJ podcast, Conversations about International Criminal Justice.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our International Network Criminal Justice podcast, Changing Lives Through Literature. What's the story? Now, uniquely, this is being co-produced with a Chinese podcast called Prison Desires. So hello to our listeners in China. We hope you enjoy this interview and the international cross-boundary nature of INCJ. This is the second episode in a series called Just Arts, when leading arts practitioners are invited to share their work with people in prison and community settings. In conversation about their experiences and very different perspectives, we hope to draw inspiration and new ideas from around the world. My name's John Scott, and today I'm sharing the hosting with a colleague from De Montfort University. So how about you introduce yourself, Xiaoye?
Hello, everyone. My name is Xiaoye. I'm currently in Leicester, and I'm originally from Beijing, China, which is almost exactly twice as far from here than to where today's guest is from, fun fact. So let me welcome Jean Troustin, author, activist, and professor from Massachusetts, United States, for today's podcast. Jean, thank you very much for being here. Today's podcast is mostly about your Changing Life Through Literature project. But first, we would like to start with asking you what you've been focusing on at this moment.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to be pronouncing your name at many times during this podcast, and you're allowed to correct me every time I get it wrong. Zhengwe?
Xiaoye.
Xiaoye. Okay. It's so not what we as people from the United States would get. So I wrote it down phonetically, and I'm still, as John says, practicing it constantly. Thank you. I work on many different areas. I work in the political arena, as you mentioned. I am a professor. I teach Changing Lives Through Literature classes. But I also am a writer, and so the book that I'm currently working on, it's my eighth book, and it's my first novel. It's called Sounds Like Trouble to Me, and it's going to be published in May 2026. And I'm actually working on another book, so that's what I'm doing right now.
Yeah, you're still excited about literature then, Jean?
I very much am excited about literature, and I think all good writers read. I think that's how you learn to write. Myself, anyway, I believe that. So reading is very much goes hand in hand with writing.
So I suppose our listeners are particularly keen to find out about your story. Were you bookish as a child?
I think that word is funny. As I said to you once, bookish is not being a nerd, but unfortunately, it's associated with it. I think to love books is to love the world of the imagination, to love the world of some other world than where you are often. Certainly, that's not always true with nonfiction, but I, as a child, always wanted to be in another world. And so that's what books were and were for me originally.
And what did you enjoy at school?
In terms of books?
Well, anything.
Well, beside reading, let's see, what did I enjoy at school? That's a really interesting question. I haven't thought about that for a long time. I enjoyed the playground. I enjoyed a lot of activity and kickball and baseball and a lot of, you know, I was very active as a kid. I liked being, you know, the good kid and the smart kid and at the, you know, doing things that the teacher wanted us to do. You know, I enjoyed that. I enjoyed, you know, school was a place to meet people, was also a place to get a lot of kudos for being smart. I like mm-hmm. that.
So what shaped your choices about going to university?
Well, my first desire when I was a young girl was to be an actress. And I had wanted that. So I went to undergraduate school. I thought maybe I'd go to a school of performing arts, but I didn't get into. It's funny, the school I wanted to go to when I was young was Sarah Lawrence. And they told my guidance counselor that my college essay was too unsophisticated. I remember that these were the days when you didn't you didn't have someone telling you how to write a college essay. You just wrote it, and you did it based on I did it based on what my mother told me to do. And so I wrote a college essay. They asked who my role model was, and I said Jackie Kennedy, which of course wasn't true. It was my mother's role model. My role model was really my grandmother, but it seemed much too embarrassing to write that my role model was my grandmother. So I didn't. And I didn't get into Sarah Lawrence because I was too unsophisticated. However, years later, I've thought quite a bit, I really like to go talk at Sarah Lawrence and say that to the students. I haven't done that yet, but I'm planning that for maybe my eighth book. Anyway, I did love theater, and I went and became a professional actress before I ended up going back to school, graduate school in theater. I got an MFA in theater, and then I started working and using the arts as a way of connecting with people.
So what drew you to acting?
I think the same thing that draws me in many ways to books, the idea that I could be someone else and experience worlds that were different from me. I love to say that when I read To Kill a Mockingbird, my desire, To Kill a Mockingbird, I don't know, is that a big book in the UK?
Yeah, lots of people read it.
So when I read that, I wanted to be Atticus Finch. Atticus Finch is, of course, a male, but when I was a girl, I didn't care. Atticus Finch was the judge. He was the person who had compassion. He was the person who showed a greater understanding of the world than the other people in the story. And I wanted to be him. I wanted to have that worldview. So that was something I got from a book. It was also something I got, say, when I would be in a Chekhov play. I wanted to be a character who had the compassion, the understanding. In Chekhov's play, I wanted to be Sonia and Uncle Vanya. But I was very attracted to classic texts, to Shakespeare, always.
Mm. So after university, you began a career as an actor.
I would say I began and ended a career as an actress. It was very quick. It was a few years. I did go to Hollywood. I did give it a shot. And I am very happy I gave it a shot because I was able to always talk to people about following their dreams.
Okay.
And that was what was most important to me about that.
Do you think we spend the whole of the rest of this podcast with Hollywood anecdotes?
I think not.
Oh, no. I was hoping that you'd met Robert Redford or Paul Newman.
Not. I did meet someone who did know Robert Redford, but not Robert Redford.
Okay. Well, in that case, we'll go sweeping on. I think it's your turn, Jiayue.
Yeah. So I'm interested in moving on from acting and a career in Hollywood, what happened next? How did your acting or drama experience influence your understanding of young people or the role that literature could have in everyday life of people?
I saw a play when I was in California. I don't know if you've heard of this play called The Cage. And the play was done by formerly incarcerated people from San Quentin. And that play, I would say, changed my life in that I had no idea people behind bars could perform plays, number one. And number two, they were so good. And I thought, this is the way theater should be used. Theater should be used for regular people, not just for people who want to be famous. Regular people need access to this. And what I meant by regular people, people who, I mean, you know, somebody who had a life experience that he could bring to a part, that's the person I wanted to see play Waiting for Godot. That's the experience I wanted to take part in. So I got my degree at Brandeis in acting, but always in my mind, I had taught college before I went to Brandeis. I always in my mind was getting back to teaching and using the arts in some way for people. And that's what I did after I got a job at a school for emotionally disturbed teenage girls in Massachusetts. And I started working with kids, doing theater with kids. Eventually, that got me into doing work in a prison where I worked for 8 years at Framingham Women's Prison directing plays. That work got me into changing lives through literature because I heard about how changing lives through literature started in Massachusetts. So it was sort of becoming characters was part of it. And then helping other people to become characters, and then talking about the worlds that books bring up that are as vivid as a theatrical world.
Could you tell us maybe one thing from your memory of working with girls that are emotionally disturbed? Although I guess that's how not what we would describe nowadays, but how was that? And if any story you could share.
Oh, yeah. One thing that was, they used to come, they'd go home on weekends and then they would come back and they would bring knives in their laundry bags. They would, you know, they would like, they were, these were girls who acted out in many ways. So acting out was the thing that got me. I said, if I can channel this energy into something theatrical, that's what it's all about. They had as much energy as anybody else. They just didn't know how to use it. So we did children's plays, and that is how they began using their energy and communicating with others. And so when I did get to Framingham, it was the same kind of thing. Channeling energy from people who had been involved with, you know, law breaking. How do we take that energy and put it on stage? And that was always the thing. So I think I'm going to use a really specific example from Framingham to make my point a little clearer, which is we were doing an improv one night, an improvisation. In other words, you don't know what's going to happen. And I gave this one woman who actually had HIV. And at the time, this was 1988, and nobody knew anything about HIV. So people were scared. She had HIV. She was an outsider in the prison and an outsider even in my class because she had HIV. And I gave her the part of Shylock to try to play, who is an outsider. This was just in experimenting in the Jewish community, and outsider in not just the Jewish community, but the world of non-Jewish community in the marketplace, so to speak. So she, the job in the improv was for her to go into a bar, not as Shylock, but as herself, and try to talk to people in the bar. And so I created a parallel situation from the play in a modern world. Go into a bar, try to talk to these people, get them to pay attention to you, tell them why it's important that you're going to do something with them, get an idea. And so she, even just breaking into a conversation became, and I told the other people, don't let her into the conversation. So that the objectives of one person versus another person collided, and Katie, her name was, the real person playing the role, eventually she played Shylock, the one who had HIV, had the experience of being rebuffed, of being an out, of being not loved, not liked, not accepted, not wanted, which was one of the kernels of what I think Shylock felt. And so that's how I would often approach taking one's emotions and experience and put them in the play, channeling it, using it, and therefore finding success through someone else's words.
This is
Sounds like it takes a lot of working with them, getting to know them and understanding, observing them to connect their individual situations and needs with characters in the text that you work with.
Well, I would get to know them, but I got to know them more when I gave, some of it was intuitive. I got to know them more as I gave them more and more improvs to do. It took us 6 months to do The Merchant of Venice, my first production. It wasn't like a regular play. I spent a lot of time working on text, having them translate the text, dealing with costumes, dealing with, you know, a lot of in-depth work.
I was going to say, this is now not a spoiler, because you lent us into the fact that you were the first person, I think, anywhere to produce Shakespeare or direct a Shakespeare play using people who were serving sentences. And you wrote a book called Shakespeare Behind Bars. Now, you've talked about that it took 6 months to open up the possibilities of this. And I think our listeners would be really interested to hear how you got permission to do this. People have taken, you know, professional actors into prisons to do Shakespeare, but to get people who are serving sentences to engage with the text, oh, that's absolutely amazing. So what's the story about that?
Well, there were always classes in prison at that time. Boston University taught in the prisons. So there were people who were volunteers in prisons at that time. But I would say to understand this is to understand that the world was different at this time. It's not the way it is now. Although I would say the aims of education and the aims of incarceration are diametrically opposed. The aims of education is to open up somebody's mind. The aims of incarceration are to follow the status quo, keep somebody very much a conformist, follow the rules. That's not what creativity is about. Creativity, in many ways, is breaking rules, is expanding one's open awareness. So, but I would say I did go, I had my brother at the time knew somebody who was working high up in a prison, and he asked him if there was a way I could direct something. And before I got permission, I sent out a grant and applied for a grant. And by the time I got permission, I already had a grant. And that's kind of how you had to do things. You couldn't exactly wait. And so I got, you know, it was like, I had to do it. I mean, they said, okay, well, why not? Let her do, she's not charging us any money. Let her do this. You know, it depends a lot on who's running each individual prison. In Massachusetts, the person running the prison at that time was a little more enlightened than maybe in some other place. But, you know, it's not... it's not like it was an easy thing to happen, but it would be 10 times harder now.
Okay. So when you got this permission, and my view is that usually you have to do things and then get permission afterwards. But when
I think that's exactly what I was saying.
Yeah. So what guided your choice, not just of this play, but I understand you did a series of different plays. So what? How did you choose your plays?
Okay, so that's a really good question. Can you see me okay?
Absolutely fine.
My eyes are a little weird. Okay, so I always felt that the greatest gift I could give people inside was giving them what I had, access to literature. They did not have, growing up, access to, quote, great literature. And I felt everybody deserved that, not just privileged people, not just people who had a good education, not just people who came from a good neighborhood. Everybody deserved access to great literature and to decide if it was something they wanted to take part in or not. So I always used classic texts that most of the women were not familiar with. Not all, some were, but most weren't. So I used, when I say classic texts, I mean texts that are considered great, that had to be translated in a sense for the prison. The women would always put the text into their vernacular, but we would start with, you know, like we did Waiting for Lefty, great Clifford Odets, Lysistrata, Aristophanes, Madwoman of Chaillot, a very famous one you wouldn't have heard of, a Latin text that was a classic in its time, Scarlet Letter, and The Taming of the Shrew. And also Arsenic and Old Lace. I did classic texts that were considered great pieces of literature. I did not do Uncle Vanya, although I loved Uncle Vanya. Sometimes I wish I had done a Chekhov, but I didn't.
And what audience did you have for these works?
The women inside. Mm-hmm. The women inside. In the beginning, I had two shows sometimes, one show for the women inside, the next day for their families. They came inside, and that was amazing. I always would make a videotape, and you know, I hope to show that to you at some point, the videotape. But they would let me send them home. Some years I could, some years there was more resistance. You know, things change so much in a prison that the superintendent changes and then policies change.
So can you assess what impact participation in these dramas and the preparation for the shows would have upon the actors upon the institutions as well?
I can tell you that the one thing that is problematic for my program is that it depended on me. It wasn't like I could develop something that I could leave behind because they didn't want me there in the first place. So it wasn't like they wanted me developing somebody to come behind me. That made it more difficult to carry on after I left. It's always in prison, often like whoever gets in, whoever gets the chance, not like a program. Now, there are programs now that do exist that have gone on and they've managed to continue, like Kurt Toflin's program, Shakespeare Behind Bars, which is a very, very important program. But what I'm saying is that it doesn't always happen that a practitioner has people to follow behind them. So you can't assess it that way. I can assess it from a couple of things. One is I would ask them, I'd give them an evaluation at the end. They would write, you know, they would write something. And many of them wrote all sorts of wonderful things. Like one woman wrote, "Thank you for giving me the chance for being someone else, even if for one day." Years later, this year, I got a letter from someone who was in five of my productions and said how she told her children how much it changed her life. There's a woman who's outside now. Her name is Angie Jefferson, and she's in the Boston community. And she was in my Taming of the Shrew adaption, Rap Shrew, with rap music. It was called Rap Shrew. And Angie was in, it was one of the shrews in the play. And she's out of prison now, 30 years she spent in prison. And now she's out like 2 years. And she came over to my house and watched herself on my TV in the production of Rap Shrew. And she saw herself. She saw her family come in. She was able to talk, see herself talking to her mother and grandmother in the prison. Her mother's passed. And so that was an incredibly important experience for her. I would say the anecdotes tell the story.
Changing lives through drama, question mark?
Well, I think you change lives through art. I think it's art. I think it's the power of transformation.
I think methods of assessment has always been a quite contentious topic in terms of creative arts and criminal justice. You always have institutions, organizations, funders wanting to see results, wanting to see impact, but how do you measure it? Whose measurement is it? Does it capture the essence of art? It's always really, really complicated. And I agree, I think anecdotes and small stories, and it's in the little things rather than data.
Right. Like and I think those are hard to assess too, mm-hmm. because they happen over a period of time, not just at the moment. That's the other difficulty about assessment.
Yeah. So Jing, the topic of today is the changing life through literature program as a whole. Could I just confirm that the place you talked about mentioned just now, were they part of the Changing Life Through Literature project, or was that before the project started?
That was before. I would like to explain, if you don't mind, what Changing Life Through Literature is as a program, because it's not something most people know about.
Yes, please.
The program got started by a judge and a professor from the southern part of Massachusetts. And it is a little bit of a kind of a chauvinistic story, but it's still a cute story to tell. I think it's chauvinistic. In the two men are playing tennis and they bet each other. One bets, I can do better than you are doing with people who are, you are locking up, the professor says to the judge. I can stop them from committing crimes with books. And the judge says, oh yeah, let's see. So anyway, it begins with kind of a challenge. And so the first group the guys had a lot of, as Judge Kane likes to say, long rap sheet. And they were on probation. In the United States, that means they're out of prison. They had conditions they had to live up to. No drugs, different kind of things. But they came every week or every 2 weeks to a literature group where the judge, the professor, and the clients sat together in what we have now come to call a democratic reading circle, where all opinions are equal, all ideas matter, and just discuss the books. And it's not therapy. It may be therapeutic, but it's not therapy. And the idea was not to talk about yourself, but to talk about the literature. And the other idea is that through literature, which is exactly what I was saying about through theater, through literature, one involves themselves deeply in characters and gets a powerful transformation through the characters often. And like I did with Atticus Finch. And so I heard about this program about 6 months after it started, and I started it with women, with a judge up near where I live, 1991, and it's a program that I have done in many contexts. Now I've done it also inside prisons. It's a little different there because you don't have, the judges still go in, but the probation, instead of a probation officer, you might have a correction officer, somebody who has to be authority force, actually reading the material and interacting on the same level as the participants. That's the theory. Everybody's voice is equal.
Mm. So most of the times the reading groups will be run outside the prison in probation context, is that right?
Yes. Yes.
Do the participants sign up voluntarily or is it tied to their probation requirement or?
Well, they have to be voluntary, but in terms of what they get from doing it, they get time off their probation. Mm-hmm. So it's voluntary, but they get something for it. We used to give off fees, but no longer, there are no fees anymore for probation in Massachusetts, in the country, actually. Well, I'm not sure the country. I take that back. In Massachusetts, there are no probation fees. So that no longer became a carrot, but time became a carrot. Also, I think for some of the participants, particularly this is what I've noticed with the men, it's a little different with women, and I've run groups for both. The women tend to look at me like, I had a dress like that once. They look at me like, I'm kind of like you, but I'm not like you. I want to be like you, but I'm not. You know, we're on the same level. But with the men are a little bit more relating to the judges, particularly when they're male judges, because it's like, I want to see if I'm as smart as, do my ideas interest you? There's a challengey thing that goes on there. So there's some mm-hmm. different male-female dynamics that go on in the groups, I think, that mm-hmm. have to also play into the dynamics of the group. But what's similar in all the groups is that people get a chance to express their ideas in a context where they're often not listened to.
And just to understand a bit more about the practical aspects of how those groups are run, would you give them text to read before they come to the class? Like my seminars for students, they never read it, but that's the setup.
Well, I think people do different things. Okay, so when I first started this program, I did it with women and I did it. We met every 2 weeks and we had a book every 2 weeks. They had to read the book. And that their assignment was to read the whole book, be prepared, be ready to talk. Most of them read the books, not everybody, not every time. You know, that was a point of discussion always. But then when we started meeting every week, in some contexts, we used short stories. That was easier for people. And unfortunately, the way the world has gotten with people not reading as much as they used to, as you just mentioned, in any context, short stories seem more doable. And I like the every week meeting because they're more accountable. So I tend to use that format more than I use the books. But unfortunately, I think you get more out of reading a book because you get a whole text. But some people use a book over weeks, a period of, I don't enjoy that format. I like a contained story that has ideas and philosophy and we can relate to and so on. And they can be long, short stories, 40 pages.
Mm, that's a long reading. Like my student will struggle reading one paper, which is about 15 pages long. Reading a whole book is probably a very strange concept to a lot of them. Would you say there's a bar for participation in terms of literacy skills or the vocabulary?
I'm just turning off something. So I don't know how to turn this off on my computer, but maybe Rob can get this off. Is that showing up my
No, it's clear on the screen.
Okay. So he'll can cut this out. All right, go ahead.
No worries. Would you say that there is a bar for participation in terms of literacy skills, or if they're all fine in terms of the basics, would there be a difference in terms of what their understanding of different styles of writing, and would they struggle with anything that you've provided them?
I think that the point of changing lives is different from regular school, in that we're not really trying to assess literacy per se. We're trying to give people, you have to be able to read to be in a group, and usually it's a self-identifiable thing. A probation officer will ask you, how comfortable are you reading? Mm-hmm. And the person says, I can't stand reading. I don't think you'll be good for this group. Mm-hmm. How come I read a book a week. Oh, then this might be something you're interested in. So it's the probation officer assesses that with the person before they begin the group. Nobody mm-hmm. gets in the group. I mean, we've had people who wanted to join it and couldn't do it, but not that often. But with women, they tend to say, I'm a terrible reader. I'm awful. I can't do anything. And they can do a lot. But they tend to think that they're awful. So we might put them in a group and say, look, you know, give it a shot, see how it goes, that kind of thing.
And do you always find them being able to connect with the stories that you have chosen? Because sometimes
part of the skill of being a facilitator for changing lives is picking the material. That's definitely a skill.
Yeah, could you share a bit more about that?
Sure. I've picked some things they've hated. I have had, you know, some awful things that I thought were, like, I used an Annie Proulx book that I thought was wonderful. And they were like, oh my God, the only character they liked in the book was the prostitute who was killed on page 10 or something like that, you know, that kind of thing. I pick books where I don't pick books with stories about rich people very often. I pick, first of all, it's fiction, which is important. Some people don't use, they use other things, but I really think fiction is crucial to this imagination. I try to pick good stories that grab people. And even if I don't think the writing is fabulous, like Jodi Picoult, she is, I'm sorry, Jodi, if you're listening, but she's not what I would call, she's not Louise Erdrich, who is one of my favorite writers, American writers, who's a Native American writer. But she's not, and Toni Morrison, who I adore their books. They're hard. I'll use Toni Morrison's books. I use The Bluest Eye, which is, I've had some of the best discussions ever. But I'll also use sort of more accessible material that somebody, you know, something like Barbara Kingsolver, The Bean Trees, or something that is more. But I this is important. For women, I'll use a lot of material by women. Mm-hmm. Like in my last class, I used James Baldwin's Sonny's Blues with the Men, which is a very, very classic story, but it spans time. And then I also used some stuff from The New Yorker, the very, very contemporary things that I found that the guys related to. Mm-hmm.
And could you tell us a little bit about how the group is run on the day? Say we are in the group with you at the very start, and how would you start the group? How would you start the discussion going about the reading?
I want to say all facilitators are different. And part of the joy of this is each person does it a little bit their own way. But the facilitator's in charge of the group. The probation officer's in charge of outside of the group, sort of like if a person doesn't read the book or doesn't come, or, you know, handling that kind of stuff. And the judge will weigh in his or her opinion, what's going on. But the way I start a group, is to start with what I call a go round. So I will have, nobody says anything, but each person goes around and has a minute or so to say some reaction. I might ask a question. I might say, so what was something in this book that really emotionally aroused you, made you angry, or made you loved it or hurt you? What engaged your emotions? And then each person says something without engaging in the conversation. And the reason I do that is to develop listening skills, also to give people a chance just to say something without any reaction to it, to be on the floor. And then we'll come back to things later. That's how I begin. And then often I will write down things that they say, and that will give me a guide to some of the things that are most important to them in the book. I am, because of my theater training, and you know this from your theater training, I have the ability to be, to go with the flow and be improvisational. And so I can vary what I might think I'm going to do in a class depending on how people respond.
So there's no format in terms of steps going forward. It's flows as you read the group and read what they want to say.
I usually come in with a list of questions.
Right. Yeah.
And I add to them or subtract from them or whatever. And and sometimes the questions, I don't get to the questions, all of them or whatever. And sometimes they have things they want to bring that I might ask them their questions. Lately, I've discovered something that was a lot of fun. Can I give you an example of a story?
Of course.
So I used a story about a young woman who is about to have an abortion. And you don't know, this is an Italian story, and I've used it in Italian prisons, I've used it in American prisons, I've used it with probation officers and judges at a training, I've used it in many contexts, and I found that the responses are surprisingly similar on a couple of the questions I ask. So we discussed the story, you don't know whether she's going to have the abortion or not, we discuss all the aspects of what happens, how'd she get to where she is, what does she feel, the guy, you know, why does she not know who the father of the child? Meanwhile, she's walking to the abortion. And then I will ask them at the end of the discussion, so a question like, and this is the one that I will ask for this story, but an open-ended question that is, there really isn't an answer to, like, so do you think she will have the abortion? And then invariably, half of them think she will, half of them think she won't. That's the first open-ended question. And then the second open-ended question that I've begun doing, and I got this idea from a dear friend of mine who's Italian, who is a theater person, and said, helped me get this question. He said, let's ask them, what do you want them to do? What will they do? What do you imagine they will do? And then what do you want them to do? And so those can be a lot of steps. So one person, for example, answered, they go in and they find out the abortionist, they sit down with the abortionist calls her parents come down, they all have a talk, and they decide she's going to keep the baby together with the, you know, they go through an entire thing. And then when I say, what do you want them to do? One woman said, goes in, finds out, has the abortionist, calls the cops come and arrest the older guy who got her pregnant, really because it was a sexual abuse case. And, you know, really interesting what they project onto the screen.
Mm-hmm. That is a great question.
It's a great question. Mm-hmm. And so it gives them a chance for their imagination. It gives other people a chance to hear different ways we see the world. And there's no right or wrong, which is an important teaching point about changing lives and about literature, which is something that we are socially teaching people to not always have, to think that there has to be one way of doing something.
Mm. That relates to the next question I was thinking as you were talking is, other than having them being able to access great literature, do you have any other goals or design in terms of what you want to achieve by choosing those texts? Because I would imagine some people, like my students or officers I worked with, they would ask, like, so what? Like, what's the point? Where do you, what do they learn out of it? Or what, where are they at the end of it?
Well, I think some side things are people end up getting more into school. Mm. Reading leads them to want to feel more confident in themselves. Mm. They go back to school, or they feel more confident at their jobs, or they read to their children. So there are things that reading gives them, not just the specific stories, but reading itself gives them, that leads places. Mm. The specific stories, I think, I am careful not to be too presumptuous that people have the same points of views that I have, because they don't. I mean, I live in a very blue state in Massachusetts, and we are, you know, very, our state votes a certain way, but that doesn't mean that there aren't people who I will encounter and who come to my class that don't think the way I think. So I have to be careful not to choose a story that I'm going to try to impose my framework on them. So example is, I did use a story, I think it was called Rib Night, I can't remember, Will Macklin. And it was about, I mean, it really is an anti-war story. But I didn't talk about it as an anti-war story at all. I talked about it in what happens in the, I mean, they could get that or not get that if they wanted it. They, you know, one guy who had been in the service, you know, talked about it in terms of what it would be like to, you know, have some of the experiences that were in the story, and how he wouldn't, you know, it's sort of from a personal vet point of view. And somebody else did, it hadn't been a vet, but I was careful not to validate or invalidate any of that, even though the story is an anti-war story. He may not be anti-war, was not my business. Mm. So you have to be careful not to presume too much about one, somebody's point of view. Or let's say, you know, a marriage, somebody's, you know, married, you know, maybe they're gay, maybe they're not gay, maybe you don't know what sexual orientation people are, how they relate to things. You know, you have a story in which there's a disparaging mark about a gay person. I think it's important to say to the class, I do, you know, well, that's a that was a disparaging remark. What did you think of that? How did that strike you, or something like that, without saying necessarily the person is bad for saying something, or the person is good, or, you know, something like that. I think that not telling them my point of view on a story is important. Mm-hmm. I think letting them, they may end up knowing my point of view, but I don't really talk about the way I see stories. I try to get them to talk about the way they see it.
Mm. So other than connecting with the story itself and focusing on various everyone's expressions or connections with the story, there's also a social element, because you are physically in the room. It's, you're not acting out, but you're still physically there. You're talking with each other. So is there anything, does anything happen in terms of the dynamic and the social aspect during those readings? And is there any stories you could share?
Well, we've had some funny things happen. Like, okay, so when I was working with the women, I had two groups of women. There weren't enough women in Massachusetts to have one class. There's so many fewer women in the criminal legal system than men. So I had women from two courts, Lynn and Lowell. And the Lin women rode a van to Lowell, and the Lowell women came in their own cars, or not with their own cars, usually their boyfriend's car, or they walked or something. They, you know, they didn't usually have the cars, bus, whatever. So a couple of books in, the Lin women accused the Lowell women of not reading the book. It was like a gang thing, you know. So there was a, we had the judge, who's fantastic, from Lin. Before the class began, we sat everybody down, and he said, all right, this stops here. People are reading this. This is happening. Knock it off. So that was sort of fascinating, the dynamic of the streets kind of coming into our class, you know, who's reading it, who's not reading it, who's getting kudos. That was interesting. Another interesting thing is there's always a graduation at the end, and it used to be in the court. And so all the women would come to the courtroom, and the judge would go up on the bench, and I would go up with him, and we'd give graduation certificates and make a speech in the court, and all people would be in the court for the day, regular court. And so these women would get kudos in front of the court. I remember when one woman brought her pimp to the graduation ceremony, and it was really exciting for her. She was friends with him. He came to the graduation ceremony. That was interesting. Socially, another thing that was sort of fascinating is I would notice if we started in the spring, they would sometimes women would be coming to the college because classes are held at the college. In the community college, we would hold them at a college, not in a court, not in a basement somewhere, in a college classroom. And they would come there, and they might be dressed like they were tricking, and that they realized, whoops, I don't think I should dress like that going to a college. Nobody told them the next class they would dress differently. So, you know, things would happen that were quite interesting socially. Last story that really, really touched me. I used a story called The Lesson by Tony Cade Bembara, which is a beautiful story about taking kids to what used to be FAO Schwartz in New York. It's no longer open. And it had gorgeous, gorgeous things for oodles of money. In the window, tons of things. And the teacher from, you know, takes the kids from Bedford-Stuyvesant, a part of New York, to a bunch of kids in the summer who are not happy, but the parents let them go, want them to go, to New York, to this fancy department store. And in the department store, the lesson is often about what things cost. And what the world is really about, and who has how much, and who doesn't have how much. That's what the story is about. And so in the story, one of the girls realizes how much it costs to have a glass sailboat, $1,000, a glass sailboat. And instead of a little sailboat, she would construct with a thing and put on a, you know, and so she gets angry, and she's angry about this, and that's a very interesting response. Well, while we were discussing it, and it's in a room with women, one of the women said, "You have no idea," and this was personal, but it was interesting, "you have no idea what it's like for a mother not to be able to afford something like that for her child. I can't even afford the tennis shoes my child wants for my child." That was very interesting. And there was a bonding of the other mothers with her that I found, you know, they get to know each other a little bit, and they get, you know, things would happen after that. Like, you know, they start bringing candy to the group or stuff. Yeah. So there's a bonding that goes on for them. Doesn't involve me necessarily, but it's for them based on those kinds of revelations or moments, personal, but also related to the story.
Okay, yeah. I want to take a step or two back, if I could, please, because you've talked about individuals and how the groups have run. The program proliferated, didn't it, in that other states used this concept. And I think it became very successful and was replicated elsewhere. It's not used quite so much now, is it? It's back in the Massachusetts area mainly. Is that not right?
Well, yeah, we haven't had the money to go outside the state to drum up business, so to speak. I am sure if we did, if somebody, you know, we hardly have money for recidivism studies, which costs a fortune. I mean, you know, to go outside the state to get new programs going, that's a lot. I mean, this is a very inexpensive program. It just involves people in a room with books or, you know, the books. I mean, facilitators are now paid, but we weren't in the beginning. We now are paid, you know, for our time. But it's not expensive, but we can't proliferate without more.
Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating to me because my wife's a librarian, for example, and there are book groups, reading groups all over the UK. And this is a very focused, engaged use of shared experiences over literature and is using that shared experience with people who've often been deprived of that opportunity. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. But you've had great experiences, and I'm just wondering how that success can be replicated, Jean. Do you think this would travel to different countries?
Absolutely. I mean, I told you I went to Italy, and I did it in Italy, and I've done it in England, and there were people doing it in England. Mary Stevenson started programs inside prisons in England, but using the Changing Lives model. I think the whole concept of being on probation doesn't exist in every country, so it might have to be translated in some ways. And judges don't always want to be in the same room with the people who they have sentenced. But the reality is that dynamic is what makes this work. It doesn't mean the judge has sentenced the person in the room, but a judge who represents sentencing is in the room.
What components do you think makes Changing Lives special?
I think the components of the people, what I just mentioned, the judge represents authority, the probation officer represents a kind of authority, and the people and the facilitator, education has been something troubling for a lot of the people we find who come into these programs. We represent something also, but then when you get the people, the thing that definitely changes is that all opinions are valid. So that idea that all opinions are valid is what makes Changing Lives particularly important. Reading, having room for listening, and speaking.
Really important.
I think not being personal to a fault is very important. I think using the literature, having the literature be the lesson, that's also very important.
And I'm interested to know. I'm interested to know whether you have mixed groups. It seems that you mainly have groups just for men, and then separately for women.
There are definitely mixed groups.
Yeah, and are they different in type?
Well, I have not run a mixed group. I have resisted it because I politically, it's me wanting the women to have something a little different. So I have resisted that. But with men, I have run men's groups, even though, and with male judges and female judges, even though, so in a way that's co-ed, but it isn't exactly because the male voices still dominate in the room. I think the difference is, if with a co-ed group, you have to be careful to make sure everybody's voice is equal, and that can be a little trickier because women tend to not always speak out when there are men there. You have, I think with a female facilitator, it's a little easier. But I think it's, if you have a male facilitator, men and women in a room, the male's got to be very skilled at getting the women to speak.
Yeah, you were going to say something, Jay.
Yes, I was going to say, I think having the court system, the sentencing, the pre-punishment aspects of criminal justice involved in a rehabilitation program is quite special. From what I've known around the different countries, I think this might be the only one that I've heard that involves judge and doesn't just involve judge. You've mentioned that it finishes in the courtroom with a very ritualized ceremony, which is really important. There's been scholars writing about that, Lashat Maruna, writing about there is a ritual to punish you and sentence you, but there's no ritual to kind of prove your redemption or that you are have been rehabilitated, but which is actually quite really important for a person and society as well. So I think that's really, really special about the program.
Yeah, and I think giving a certificate so people have something that they take home, an acknowledgement of their work, that also adds to it. So the courtroom, not all programs do that, but I found it incredible. It was so wonderful when I did this program 27 years with Judge Dever, and he was from Lynn, and he used to ride the van every time to Lowell with the women in the van. And so when we had the graduation, he was always in, you know, he came in sweats or whatever is, you know, to the program. But in the graduation, there he was in his robe on the podium, and they had never seen him in his robe. That's not who he was. He was not that role. And so the role took on a new meaning. He was an empathic judge now, not the judge of their fears. Plus, in our situation, Judge Dever's portrait was in the courtroom. And so it was really, really profound for the women.
Might also be profound for judges around the world to be inspired by how that judge handled his role. I'm wondering if people listening would like to find out more about this methodology. Where should our listeners go, Jean?
I just wanted to finish the last thing I was going to say. Judge Dever used to say, "This is the joy of my judgeship about changing lives," because there was joy, which is not always connected to being a judge. Well, people can email me. That's probably the easiest thing. You can give my email out, jean@trounstein.com, put it up somewhere on the screen if they want to know. That's probably the easiest. And then I can field their questions to people and help them get materials or find out who they should talk to. But judges can contact me too, because I am one of the people on the Changing Lives Through Literature Committee in Massachusetts, who does help people who want to start programs.
I have another question related to the content of the work. In terms of, are there any points in working with them that you pick text that relates to crime and offending specifically? Do you do that at all, or is that just is that not your consideration? Because I've heard lots of questions from the general public with a rather punitive mindset asking, are they reflecting on what they've done wrong? Are they repenting, or are they just having a good time? What would your response be to that?
Well, I really think the point of changing lives is not to I think there's a mistake if you take if you have a program and you try to be didactic. I think being didactic is the death of any program with literature. So I think to use literature as a way of saying, oops, you shouldn't have done that, you shouldn't have done that, is wrong, is not the way to use it. So I certainly have stories that have crime in it, but not for the purpose of like this, you know, for them to see what their reactions are to it, to see what their feelings are. So that I might use Joyce Carol Oates' story, great story, Where Are You Going, Where Have You Been, where there's a young girl by the end of the story, you know she's going to get raped, and to see what their reactions are to her going, does she fight back enough? Does she not fight back? Is she, quote, asking for it? Is she not asking? You know, there is no right or wrong. I think there is no right or wrong with literature. And that's why it's powerful, because it allows, the literature allows us to teach. It's not just having fun. It's engaging the mind with questions and thoughts and what do you think and how do you think and how many ways to think. That's not just, quote, fun. It's really developing thinking skills. And I mean, that's fun for me, but I think if you go into something with the notion that you have to show people the right way, dead in the water.
Well, I think we probably got to the stage in our podcast where it's time for a last word from Jean. So you have an international audience, and I'm just wondering whether you could say something about how you think the arts can contribute to justice, Jean.
Okay, not a big question or anything like that.
No. I mean, just the last word. You can do it in maybe three or four words.
Just a small question. Well, I think that the arts open people up to their heart. I think they're open people up to the world of the imagination. I think the arts open people up more to ideas they didn't know they had. I think through the arts, we can grapple in a very safe, in a much safer way with some of the tough things that go on in the world. I mean, if you don't mind a small diversion, but I'd like a small diversion. I went to a Yankees, I'm a Red Sox baseball fan, and this is, we have a very big thing in our city, Red Sox, Yankees. Yankees are New York, Red Sox are Massachusetts. We are a terrible fighting team. We fight each other. But I just wrote an essay that really, isn't this a better rivalry to have than a rivalry, the kind of rivalries we have in the world that are going on, that end in the kind of brutal consequences we see all over the world? What better than to see the brutality in a piece of literature and see it, talk about it, engage in it, rather than do it? What better to see a brutal man hit his daughter and engage in that and experience it and ask questions about it? You know, with Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, there's sex abuse. But when I asked the women in my class, does Charlie, when he touches Piccola, thinks he loves her? Judge Dever flipped out and didn't want the women to talk about it. But the women said, be quiet. We want to talk about it. Yes, he thinks he loves her. And that, for them, was a revelation about what that meant. Not something they could have ever talked about with their own abuse, ever. Mm. But they can talk about it with someone else's on the page safely. And that is the gift. And I think it is a gift.
Mm. Well, thank you very much, Jean. This is an amazing and varied story, which is bound to inspire practitioners who love both books and drama and who know they work with people who've got in trouble with the law and who make bad and good choices maybe every day. So thank you very much for sharing time with us today. Now, we're planning to reach out in other podcasts in the coming months to Germany, China, Australia, and we're hoping to talk to a true crime writer in future podcasts. So please keep a watch out, everybody, for upcoming events. So
John,
thank you.
I would like to say one thing for people.
Please do. Yeah.
I would hope they can contact me. But also, if you want to find out more about my work, go to jeantraunstein.com and you can find out about my work there and about my writing and my books and so on. But I'm happy to also be a font of changing lives through literature.
Brilliant. What we'll do is we'll make sure that there's a list of contacts on our website. And please do take up Jean Traunstein's offer of contact, because she's been very open today and will continue to be so. Jean, you're a star. And actually, you should have made it at Hollywood. And then we could have talked about Robert Redford. Okay. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you to everyone for watching and listening to this podcast. If you want to find out more about INCJ, just visit our website at criminaljusticenetwork.net or go to Spotify or your preferred podcast provider to find other topics of interest that you might want to follow up on. So I think all that's left to do is to say goodbye from the three of us. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening.
You have been listening to the INCJ podcast, conversations about international criminal justice. To find out more, go to our website at criminaljusticenetwork.net or follow us on Twitter at INTCJ Network.